everyone. It's your host, Steven, and you're listening to the Learn Swift podcast. I've got Greg Shidwa here. He was back on episode 5, I believe, and he's recently launched it. Like, since he came on last time, he's launched his app, and he's gone through... You're on 1.1.2. You just released that recently. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And I wanted to bring you back on to talk about, you know, because you had a long test flight process. Like, you were, and I constantly, like, you know, you're talking about, like, you're very open about your process on Twitter. And I just wanted to kind of bring you back on to talk about that.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. It's been a long, long road, I guess. I've started working on this app around June last year. So the reason I released it now is because my dev subscription was coming up to a renewal, and I was like, well, I better release something on the first sort of year I had before I subscribed again, you know, renewed it. So that's why the release. It's been a long process, and you're right, like, I had a lot of testing happening on test flight, mostly because I was trying to move away from a model where, you know, in my head, the app would do A, B, and C, and it was fine for me. But now I had to take into account other users and what they want. And if the way I've designed it was comfortable to me because I've designed it and I knew where to go to do things, but I then needed to make it more logical and the user interface more sort of self-explanatory to new users, that's why the test flight took about, I don't know, I started in December, just before Christmas. Yeah, December was the first test flight build, and then in June I've released the app. So 6 month incubation, basically.
Yeah, that's it was pretty cool seeing the progression and how you talked about, like, things on Twitter, because I remember I don't know what you ended up doing, because I haven't had enough recipes on there to, like, see it. And but I remember, like, you were on Twitter talking about a certain animation where they kind of, like, each row would kind of, like, kind of slide into place almost.
Yeah, so I was playing with essentially, the recipe list is a table view, right? And, you know, a table view will just pop out of, once the data is loaded, it'll pop, and it just kind of looks very jerky because it goes from there being nothing to there being something without any sort of smoothness or anything. And then, God forbid, your internet connection drops while you're loading the recipes, then just the text comes up and not the pictures and so on. So, because everything's stored on the in the database. So to play around with that, I did a few builds with different animations. So I had some that sort of came in from the back, so they zoomed in. I had some that slid in from the sides, you know, different types of animations. And I've tested those out, and I'm glad I did, because turns out that any animations in table views will cause, on slower devices, will just either cause the app to crash because it's, you know, it's using a lot of memory, or it'll slow down visibly. So I just, in the latest build, the one I released recently, I've changed all the animations to sort of fade in, because it doesn't really animate anything. It just changes the alpha setting of the cell, so it goes from 0 to 1 in like 0.3 seconds. So in that 0.3 seconds, all the data is fetched, so by the time you see everything, it's all there, rather than waiting for an image to populate or the text to come up. So that's essentially just to hide all the fetching to happening in the background. That was the reason for the animation there. But yeah, I did test, I think, 5 or 6 different approaches, and I even had, at some point, I've even experimented with per device animations. So if you had an older device, I'd say, well, maybe don't do animations there and only do it on the newer ones. But then, you know, I figured that's not really a good user experience, so I found an animation that's very that isn't resource heavy, so it all looks smooth and lets you essentially enjoy it, and you don't feel like there's something going wrong with the app.
How did you check for what particular device somebody had? What is it? Because I've messed with, I would imagine it's probably like a compiler flag. But I've only ever messed with, like, iOS versions and certain in some of the newer stuff, like if can import like UIKit or something like that. How did you determine what device somebody was running?
Well, I went the deployment target for Foot Planner is iOS 11, so that essentially means iPhone 5s and up, right? So because iPhone 5s is the lowest device that can run iOS 11, and then knowing that, I went for the size of the height of the screen. So if the height was less than 600, then it would have been an iPhone 5S. And if it was larger than that, it'd have been either a 6 and up. And iPhone 6 and up could handle all the animations fine. It was just the 5S that had problems with them.
Oh, okay. So you sent... That makes sense, because that's when the size change happened.
Yes. I've also had to use the height of the display for some other animations. So, for example, in the app, every screen has a little drawer on the bottom. But that drawer, the way the animation works, it essentially extends the drawer from the bottom constraint of the screen, right? So if you're in a 5S or a 6, 7, or 8, not the plus devices, the height of the total height of the drawer is less than it's on the plus devices and the iPhone X, because on those it just looked too long, because the screen is slightly longer, and it just kind of broke the proportion of what's in the drawer and what's on the screen. Because I went for every time the drawer opens, it takes up about 2/3 of the screen, but on the bigger models it ended up being more like 3/4, and it just looked off, and there was a lot of empty space on the bottom of it, because all the buttons and all the UI within the drawer is designed to kind of stick to the top of it. So it was essentially just extending the bottom, and it looked sort of abandoned and desolate there in the top of the screen. So I've ended up designing a class that just checks for the height of the screen and adjusts a number of constants depending on that. And then that's done at startup. So it's only done once, and it's held in a defaults file. So then every animation that requires that height sort of feeds back from that class and figures out how to do all the proportions and all the size changes.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty involved process. But you know, I mean, you've got to definitely consider the best experience for the particular user, no matter what device you're using. So that's a pretty interesting approach. Mm. I'm in test flight right now myself with Kevin. He was on the one I did before Joe Fabisevich. He's the designer or brand strategist. Mm. But he's a designer by trade, essentially. He kind of moved into more or less like management. Mm-hmm. But you know, he pretty much had the idea for the application, and he heard me say that, you know, hey, you need design help, I need development help, so let's get this. Yeah. So we're in test flight right now, and one of the things that I noticed, we have like one crash, which, you know, we've got 13 beta testers, and I had one crash on one device, and it's never happened again. But it was kind of weird, because it didn't really give me any. It just happened. It happened on the main thread, but nothing else was really apparent. It would give me like the line of code that it took it to. It didn't really make a whole lot of sense why it would crash there. What have you had any weird like crashes that you were kind of had a hard time to like debug and figure out like what is actually causing this crash based on the crash logs you're getting from test flight?
Yeah, and it took me a while to figure out what was causing it, but essentially I had one user who was getting a crash in the, you know, just at the beginning. So, you know, in the app you switch between tabs, and you know, the third tab is your recipe tab, and whenever you load that up, the database is queried for the list of your recipes and then it fetches everything you have. So he was getting crashed there and the app would just completely crash. And then when you launched it again, it was as if, you know, nothing had happened. So I got the crash log from him. And like you said, it showed where the crash occurred in the code and the line and everything, but there was no reason for it to happen. It was essentially happening at the point where the recipe was already there and was meant to be displayed. So the assumption was that the recipe has been fetched. It's just for whatever reason the UI table couldn't display it. So I tried to force the crash on my test device and I couldn't get it and everything worked perfectly. I've even, you know, asked him to create a new account with, you know, a test password and see if he was getting the same problem, and then I tested on my device. And essentially what happened was the recipe class is full of placeholders. So when the app first loads, because I'm using forced unwraps, which I know I shouldn't, and I'm working to get those out, I'm using a lot of placeholders to say this is where the title is going to be and this is where the URL is going to be, an image and so on. But whenever you sort of initiate a query from Firebase, after Firebase checks with you to say yes, this user exists and yes, they have a database entry, the class drops all the placeholders, so they're empty, and it waits for the data from the database to come in to populate all the variables. And what was happening was that the query went out, the database confirmed yes, everything's there, so wait for the data that I'll give you. It was basically just promising to give you the data, and then it didn't. And it turned out it was because the user had a Raspberry Pi with a pie hole on it. So all their network traffic would have gone through that. And it's essentially blocked a number of, you know, ad services and so on. But it also blocked Google ad services, which is required for Firebase. And what happened was you could still use the pie hole to ping the database and say, yeah, everything's there. But it couldn't send you data because essentially Pi-hole thought it's an ad, so it blocked it. So every time they connected through Wi-Fi, they connected to the database, say that the data is there, but the data could never reach them because any traffic from Firebase was being blocked. So I've asked him to set up a whitelist for that for Firebase, and it's a set of two or three different URLs that you have to whitelist, and it works now because it worked on his cellular network. It won't work on his Wi-Fi. And I've actually had to create an FAQ as well on my website to say that if your app is crashing in this particular thing, and you have an ad blocking service on your router, then maybe whitelist these three URLs. And they're not ad URLs, they're just, you know, Google services or whatever, but, you know, because a lot of ad services sort of piggyback right on these, they're outright blocked by ad blockers, and that interferes with my app. But it's something I never considered originally.
Well, you know, at least your beta tester had that. Like, you wouldn't have found that until it was in production. If your one user didn't have that. I've never even heard of that. I actually kind of want to look into that now, because
it's great. Just make sure you unblock this if you're using my app.
Yeah.
But like, funnily enough, I have the same setup. Like, I have a Pi-hole and everything, but because I had issues with connecting to the console as a developer, I've unblocked everything much earlier than before I started Test Flight. So it never happened to me because it was already letting it through. And it, you know, it didn't dawn on me at the time to ask the question with the user. So eventually we find it out, but it wasn't even through troubleshooting of the app, because none of the logs mentioned this. It was just, you know, well, out of curiosity, does it happen on your cellular? And it's like, no, it doesn't. So there was clearly something on the Wi-Fi. And then we kind of arrived at the fact that he has a non-standard network setup.
That's interesting. So does the... Everything, so all the network traffic is routed through the the Raspberry Pi, does that slow down? Like, just like, this is completely like, this is a little off topic, but does it slow down? Does it kind of like bottleneck at the Raspberry Pi? I would imagine that, like, or does it only check the like just like where it's coming from, and it's like kind of off to the side, and then we'll block. I don't know. It just seems like because the Raspberry Pi doesn't have a whole lot of like resources, and it seems like that it might throttle the flow of data.
Well, from my experience, it actually speeds it up. So essentially what happens is you set up a server on the Raspberry that you essentially create your own DNS server on the Raspberry Pi. And then whenever you go to a website, it just pings the DNS server to see, can I go there? Or like, what is the domain for this? And it slows it down, but it also speeds it up because all the ads don't have to load. So you don't notice the slowing down because it's sort of made up for and then some by the fact that your websites load much faster.
Interesting. What about, so does any, like, so say if you're downloading anything, are the bits still going through the Raspberry Pi, or are they just going straight from like your router to your computer? Does it even like, does that stuff have to pass through the Pi?
No. So it's just a DNS server. Okay. It doesn't, okay, all the traffic then still goes through your router, right?
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking of it kind of like almost like a firewall, I guess. Not so much a DNS or anything like.
No.
My mental model of that was wrong, which I guess you could say is the source of all bugs.
True. True. As far as I know, you can set it up in a firewall mode, but you know, I never found the need for it, and the way my network is set up, all my devices go to the Raspberry just to check the DNS, but everything else goes through the router, so it's fine.
Okay, that's cool then. So let's talk more about Test Flight. Mm. So one of the, as far as user engagement goes, how has that been? Like, what would you say that the percentage of your beta testers are actively giving you feedback versus like some are more or less just passive, like it's helpful like whenever they have crash logs, but you're not really getting a whole lot of information out of them? I would probably fall into this bucket, but
well, it's been really sort of spotty most of the time. So when I launched Test Flight, I had 50 users to start with, and now I have 13 because or 14 because, you know, over time, once I've noticed that people weren't installing the new builds, there's no point pushing builds to them. So rather than, you know, pestering them, sending emails saying, oh, there's a new build, download this, I've essentially moved them. I have a separate sort of group in Test Flight that doesn't get emails. But if they open the app, the Test Flight app, they can update my app if they want, because I don't want to, you know, antagonize users. Feedback wise, I've only essentially the ones who I kind of kept actively engaging with were the ones who actually came back to me with feedback, and there was a few ones who actually sent me detailed, you know, like nearly an essay on like what they like, what they don't like, and what they'd improve, and so on. So a lot of the features I never thought of came from my users there, and I've implemented them since, and kind of, you know, I've grown to like them as well. But none of those features were my original idea when I set out to build the app. And even more so because the app is for sharing meals. That's like half of what the app does. You sort of need to have a friend with it. So not everybody who's willing to do a test flight might know somebody else who's willing to do. So I had like three or four users who like invited their partners or their family to kind of test out the sharing capability. And these users are the ones that actually come back with feedback and so on. But my experience was that a lot of people kind of try it for 2-3 versions and they kind of fall off, or they never come back with a feedback, or even more so disable the, you know, when you set up iOS, you can say, you have a tick box to say that you send on statistics to your developers. Some of them had that disabled, so I wouldn't even know if the app crashed or not. You know, they'd only say, oh, the app crashes. Like, well, not by what I can see. Send me logs, you know. So it's right now I'm struggling trying to find more users for Test Flight 2, especially now that the app is live. It's more crucial to do all the testing before I go to the App Store, because I don't want to, you know, my sort of target audience users experiencing crashes that I could have caught in development. So, you know, every time I can get a new user, that's great, because I want to do like two different channels where I test different implementations of the same feature to see which one's better. But I can't do it right now because I don't have enough testers.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not really directly interfacing with the users on TestFlight so much, other than like the handful of people that I brought on. Most of them are Kevin's contacts, so I can't really speak. I guess he could speak to that better than I could. But as far as like for my experience, it's been like they'll play with the app. And then they'll play with the app, like essentially like at first to help out, you know, and then it's like after that, it's just like, like, do I really have to do this over and over again? Like,
yeah.
So, yeah. So that seems to be that. And I'm sure that's common with every beta test.
True, because like, you know, group. It's different if you as a user download the app from the App Store because you have a need to do something with that app, and then you might come back to it. But if you're asked to test it, you mightn't even thought about ever using it, and now you're asked to do some work on it. So it's not even, you're not benefiting from it as you were. Your need isn't being met. You're just being pestered to test something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, those people, you know, you need like, you know, the friends and family that'll do that. And or random people that are just willing to help. But yeah, I mean, it still helps, because like I think the one person it crashed on, though, it was on a device that like wasn't very, so the app that I'm working on with Kevin is a game. It's like a UI kit game. Mm-hmm. And you can like share, like you can share like characters and stuff like that. It's a fun little cute game or whatever. It's a little card match game, and then you know, it's mostly targeted towards kids, like with the way the characters are, and like, you know, the character profiles are very, you know, it's geared towards children. Mm. So like you have a bunch of adults doing testing, for the most part. And then, so keeping them engaged, at least in my mom is the one who ended up getting the crash, but it was on an iPad Pro 12 point whatever inch. And mm-hmm. like, that's obvious. That's not a device I have. That's not really a device that I tested on, like yeah. even in the simulator, because it's like huge. And then And she couldn't, I don't think she's been able to reproduce it. So we just don't know. So, it was just some weird bug. Just one time. I don't know.
I've recently discovered that Apple uses that 12 inch iPad for testing all the apps for the App Store. Because every time I submit an app for review to go to the App Store, I have this one user who just uses an iPad. And even that app is not optimized for use on iPad. It looks horrible because it's just the UI enlarged and everything's kind of grainy and whatnot. So I figured out that it must be Apple, because then, you know, with Firebase, you can sort of see the general area they're in. And it seems to be Cupertino whenever somebody logs in from that iPad. So maybe do track that issue, because if you're trying to release it, then it might crash on Apple.
Yeah, maybe. So, you know. And then Kevin actually had another contact that had the same type of iPad, and that person hasn't had that issue. So yeah, it's very, 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 very difficult to figure out what it is, because like I said, it's just like the stack trace isn't very informative. And yeah, I don't know. It's weird. So, and like I said, it hasn't repeated. So that's a good sign. Off.
Yeah. Or you fixed it in a version since then.
We haven't even uploaded a new build yet. I think this beta went out last week, and I've done a few fixes, but I still have a couple more things to address before I think that we're going to push out another test flight build.
You're more of a sort of, I'll collect my fixes before I do a release in test flight.
Yeah. Well, the fixes that I made were more like cosmetic. They weren't, pretty much all the fixes are cosmetic. We haven't had, other than the one crash, we haven't had any other issues. The rest is just essentially like UI fixes. So it's not you know, there, it's kind of cosmetic. It's not very there was a account, a lot of users had a problem with the on when you get to a certain level, the cards are like, it's kind of a toss up because on the hard level, you have to end up scrolling to match cards, which is kind of like difficult. And so it kind of kind of annoying as a user, I guess you could say. And so it was just kind of unanimous, like no scrolling, please. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I got to fix. But like I said, it's more or less of a, it's just changing the UI a little bit, like making the cards shrink to fit onto the screen. It just doesn't look as nice as the cards filling up across the screen, because you want to keep the same aspect ratio, and then you know, it's just kind of like that, more or less than, like, you know, there's no critical, you could call that critical because none of the users like the scrolling, but it's not it wouldn't keep us from getting it into the App Store, right? Nothing crazy's happening.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'd now have to start figuring how to implement scrolling, because I was like that in the beginning. Like, obviously, my table views were scrolling, whatever, but I was sort of adamant at in Food Planner not to have your main view. I didn't want that to scroll. I want everything that you could possibly need to be on that one screen, and you don't have to really move around, you know. But now, because I'm trying out new ideas and adding new features, I ran out of space. And otherwise it'll look cramped. So I'm thinking about introducing a scroll view here and there, so I can fit the features that I want, especially on smaller devices, because I have an 8 Plus. So everything I want to see fits perfectly on my screen. But I've noticed the majority of my users will have the non-Plus device or an iPhone 10, and then you have to, you know, account for the fact that they'll see less of the screen than I do, and because of this, I have to you know, be sort of inventive with how I lay out my UI. But this feature that I want to introduce is just saying it on the welcome screen, you'll have you know, whatever meal you're planning for today, but underneath you'll have the last three recipes you added, or, you know, further on, when after you've been using the app for a while, it's going to be the recipes that you haven't used for a while, you know, so just to kind of keep things fresh. But to do that, I have to have like a little scroll view, just so you can see all the three recipes.
Okay. Yeah. I'm a Plus user as well. And then so is Kevin. And so, like, you know, whenever you test, like, when you test on your device, like, you're like, oh, this looks good on, you know, it looks good on the device. And then, like, it's like, well, okay, after I've done all this work and I've moved on to something that's like, wait a second, I need to look and see how this looks on the other device. It's like, oh, yeah, dang it. I made some assumption and now I need to, now I'm paying for it and I've gotta go refactor something. One thing that I will say about scroll, like, so stack views inside of scroll views are tricky. I don't know if you're using stack views.
I am, but that's not going to be a stack view. I'm going to use a collection view inside a scroll view. So that's interesting.
Oh yeah. So why don't you do a collection view inside of a table view?
Well,
like, are you like, how are you? Like, is your collection view scrolling from left to right?
Yes.
And okay.
So it's essentially under, you know, on the main screen, on the welcome screen, you have the thing like, hi, you know, Greg, today you're having, and then it's a picture of what you're having and the title of what it is and the button saying make now. Underneath that, I'm going to have essentially three recipes side by side, and where you can only see the first one, and then you can see like one third of the second one. So you have to scroll to see the other two. Do you know what I mean? So that's why it's going to be a collection view, because I want that. And then it's going to be a scroll view, so you can see that collection view on like a 5S or an iPhone 6 or 7, the smaller size, because it's going to be clipped by the height of the screen. Because I don't want to like scrunch the images too much.
Okay. Let me see. I'm trying to add more recipes. I've got your app pulled up. So, let me see. Shows you how often I've used it. I love the drawer though. I play with the drawer. I love it. I would say that anybody that wants to see how animations can be done well and smooth should take a look at your app and just see how you've implemented your drawer, because it bounces nicely. It's not too bouncy. It's bouncy enough. And then how your text scales. Like, so I'm looking at your home screen. It says, "Hey there." And you've got the hand waving emoji. And then it just kind of comes up real nice. I don't know. It's just very nice. Very fun to just look at and play with. What did you use Core Animation, or did you use UI Property View Animator? Like, what were you using to do the animation on that?
So I use both in the app, but for this in particular, I used the Property View Animator because I needed. There's just in that pulling up, there's like five different animations happening, because you have the actual background going up, and then you have the text changing size, you have the background of the screen darkening, and you also have the buttons appearing. So you in UI View Property Animator, you can chain animations. So I have all of them starting at the same time, but they take a bit different animations will take different times. So then when it actually pops up, the entire animation takes about 0.6 seconds, but different sections of it happen at different times. I originally had it just with, you know, UI View Animate and so on, but it was just choppy as hell every time you did it. And especially on this, on my device, it was fine because, you know, it's the latest one. But if somebody ran it on a 5S, it just looked really, really jerky and very sort of, you could actually nearly see the frames changing. So I, with this, it's all nice and smooth. So I'm now migrating most of my animations to UI View Property Animator away from, you know, UI View.animate, just I can stay consistent.
I've messed around. Go ahead.
Yeah, because the originally I didn't know about UI View Property Animator until I went through, I think it was WWDC 2016. Yes, because it's from iOS 10. Where there was a talk about just this, and I watched it and it's like, oh, that looks amazing. And I tried to figure it out and I had some issues. So I asked some other guys on another podcast if they've used it, and they've pointed me to some other resources, and I kind of figured it out. But it's hard to, like, the learning curve is very steep, but once you get it, it clicks, and then you're fine doing all your animations. And it's a bit more involved than doing UI View Animate, because there's a lot of steps you have to go through. But I think it's worth it, because then you get that sort of drawer with all that nice bounciness in it. And I think it's worked quite well. I have to say I'm quite chuffed with it too.
Yeah, I've messed a lot. I don't have any. Trying to think of some of the stuff that I have going on in Smonsters, which is the app that's in test flight right now. I do know I've done it's a little bit of Core Animation and a little bit of UI View Animate. I might change it around a little bit, because I have noticed I'll have to look at it. It's like, it would be, I don't know how noticeable it would be. It might be noticeable to me, but maybe not the users. It's stuff that I got that I might play around with and whatnot. But I haven't used UI. I've toyed around with UI View Property Animator a little bit, and I do it's like you said, you add like different animation, like it's essentially separate closures, but they all run on the same animator.
Yes.
So you don't have to worry about calling a bunch of nested UI View Animate.
Yeah,
calls,
exactly.
If you want to do that, so that's what I really like about UI Property View Animator. But I'm not nesting any of those really, so like I didn't really like see an immediate need for it. But I might take a look at it a little bit closer to see if it's a good fit for what I'm doing in Smonsters.
Also, the fact that you can interrupt the animation, and you can interrupt it, and you can either reverse it or you can continue with this. You can't do that with UI View Animate, because once you do that, you either have to return to the final stage or the first initial stage and then start the animation again, because if you were to interrupt it and then restart it, it'll just start the whole animation from the point you interrupted it. So you'll add on top, do you know what I mean? Whereas with Property View Animator, it's essentially just like scrolling through the progress of it, and it just says, I stopped at 25% of completion, so it'll only do 75% rather than doing the whole 100% again.
Right. Yeah. 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 I actually have toyed with that too. None of the animations in the app are really, most of them are transition. So I've got transition animations. Mm-hmm. And then like whenever the cards flip over, those are really the only the animations that I do. We have a game setting menu type of screen in there. And it's only, it only takes up like half of the, like, so I had to do some crazy stuff in there actually. I most of the custom views that I made, are all in code. And then like pretty much we've got some storyboard stuff, but it was mostly just placeholders for a lot of the stuff that was in there, because a lot of stuff that I was doing, like, it just couldn't be done in storyboards, because I've got like stack views that have dynamic sub stack views based on like level difficulty. And, you know, I set like the height of the, like, to make everything look good. We had a collection view in there to begin with, but that kind of was not so optimal for, I mean, we need everything on screen anyway at once. So it kind of didn't really get any of the benefits of collection view. Because if it needs to be on screen and in memory anyway, collection view isn't really, I mean, you just kind of add a lot of complexity to just have things spaced out how you want them, because you still got to mess with like the collection view flow layout delegate, and then it just ended up being easier to do it in stack view. So I remember what I was talking about. I went off on a tangent there. So for the game view animation though, what I ended up doing was, it's kind of tricky. So like whenever you do a present animation, like, it actually removes the back, like the previous view, it removes it like anything. So the idea was to have the screen kind of come over from the right, and then kind of fade the, like, darken the view behind it. And you may have experienced, I don't know exactly what you're doing with the drawer, but the view, the background view ends up getting essentially removed. So what I initially did is I just took like a snapshot of the, essentially like a screenshot, and made it a UI image and had it in the background. Okay. So that way it's still like a screenshot. It was like some, like, you use the image renderer and then you do image render, and then you draw the whole view context into the CG context.
That's interesting. Because because like you said, the view behind gets removed, and whenever I was dismissing the drawer, the actual what was meant to be there was gone. I was like, what the hell? So I ended up doing was like just creating, just for the purpose of it, creating like a background view while the drawer was active, and then that's being dismissed. But it took me a good 2 days to figure out why, because, you know, when the animation, you say, oh sure, you know, you add the layer and then you have to remove it when it's done. But at that time, the layer to remove was the actual background layer that you needed to stay there. And I couldn't visualize it in my head how the, you know, layer stack worked. But that's an interesting solution you came up with, because it never occurred to me to do that, just to, you know, take a screenshot, as it were.
The problem that we found, though, was because on iPhone, this wasn't a, so on iPhone we only support portrait. Mm-hmm. It just like the way the UI is, it just doesn't really lend itself to a great portrait mode experience or landscape mode experience. So like, you know, if you're playing the game and you're going in portrait, or God, I keep messing that up. If you go over into landscape, it's just not, you know, it's just not, the screen's not big enough.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, this game, like, and like all the other screens on the iPhone, it's just a better experience just to be in portrait. For iPad, however, like, you know, it just seems like there was like, you could still have a good experience in any orientation because the screen is just big enough. Like even on the iPad mini, right? It's just, it's still big enough. It's still, you still have a good experience.
I see where you're heading with this.
Yes. So if you're, and I don't know how many people are going to do this, but like, I'm not the kind, like, I'm not going to ship something that looks wrong.
Yeah.
So if you go, whenever I, if you go to the menu and then you switch orientations while you're in the menu, then if you were in landscape first, and then go to portrait, then you've got this like black bar where the background was.
Yeah.
What I ended up doing was, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. Essentially, I created a copy of the view. And then like, so I created a copy of the view using NS Keyed Archiver.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd essentially NS Keyed Archiver, save the and make a copy of it that way, and then I would essentially recreate the new view so now that when I do the rotation, the background still changes with it, but it's still a dummy view.
Yeah.
As soon as you dismiss the menu, you're back to the live view. But this way it actually rotates with it. With the image, you don't get any of that. So it's creating the snapshot in the orientation that you were in. But then when you rotate, it's just like taking the image and, you know, you keeping it the same, but now you've got this space there that it just looks silly. Yeah. Like I said, though, I don't know how many people are going to be rotating their device while they're in the menu, like, right? Because it's just not like one of those screens where you would be like, oh, this, you know, maybe this makes more sense to hold it this way.
Mm.
But it was an interesting problem. It actually ended only up taking me a few hours to figure it out. But it was like one of those things that just like, it was one of those problems where like, I don't even know where to start to think about this, because the whole reason why I did the snapshot was because I didn't have the view there to begin with, and I couldn't figure out the best way to do that. So I just made a snapshot and was just like, oh, this is easy peasy. I'll just do this. But it turned out not to be the best solution. Now, if the device didn't support any orientation, like, you know, if it only supported one orientation, I would never even come across that issue.
Yeah.
But the fact was that I essentially, you know, just rotating it over. Because there's a few other things too. Like you can do a copy of redraw a view, copy essentially, but it loses the constraints. So like the way I did it, it just saves everything and everything rotates just perfectly. And yeah, it was just a weird thing that I found before we pushed to test flight.
And do you lay out your view in code, or do you storyboard, or like both? Because based on what you're saying, like a lot of the sort of logic has to be adjusted to code.
Some of it, it's a mix. I'd say it's a lot of the stuff that Kevin had already done, like in storyboards. A lot of that stuff, if it was already largely in storyboards, I left it in storyboards because I didn't want, like, I wasn't trying to reinvent like what he had already taken care of for the most part. Like all the stuff was there. I might have needed to change some things a little bit, but I didn't want to, we already got a good home screen. I didn't need to just go back to the drawing board and redo it in code. But for a lot of the stuff, it is mostly code. All my cells are zibs. Like, so my collection view cells that I do have are zibs. So that I can share them between, because we have two different collection views in there. So you can choose like your card backs. So he's got all these designs for, like, you know, so if you can, when you unlock the app, you can get like up to, you could choose up to like 10 different card backs. So they all look different. And then there's like the, like all the characters in the game, you can go through and like, you know, there's a collection view that scrolls side to side, and they look like they're, you know, it looks like they're cards in the game, but they're just a bit bigger, and you can select them and go to their profile detail essentially. But they essentially use the same, it's the same thing. It's a image, and it's got an accessory type of thing, where it's like, if it's locked, like, so that the user knows that they can't, like, you know, if they select this, you know, they can't do it unless they've unlocked the game. So they're both the same, but they're in two different collection views. So if you do like prototype cells in Storyboard, you can't share cells between two different collection views. So the best way to go about doing that is to have a zib. And that way you can share your collection view cells between two different collection views. But most of this, okay. Yeah, most of the stuff though that most of the stuff that I did was code. I found it like I starting out, like if you would have asked me, if you were to ask me when I first, what if you were to ask me when I first had started, like back in episode 5 when I first had you on, if you would have asked me about doing layout and code, and I think we actually may have did talk about that a little bit, I just wasn't there. I just did. I had no clue how to do it, and I knew it was a thing, but I didn't even know where to start. Storyboard was where I was at. Now, for the most part, I feel a lot. I can at least get it to where it needs to be in code faster, because I can now, like back then, I was still very visual with it. I couldn't visualize what it was going to look like as I wrote the code. Now it's the opposite, because I feel like it takes me, you know, well, you've got to go through like, you got to go through interface builder menus, and you've got to go through like, whereas in code, it's like in interface builder, if you want to make something a proportional width to something, you've got to go through, like, you've got to do like 5, 6, like you've got to do several like things to get it to do that. Whereas in code,
yeah,
if you want to make it proportional to the view, it's just like, it's a lot simpler.
I'm exactly the same. Like now, all the, like that whole drawer thing, that's all in code. And then every time you'll see any animation pop up coming up, that is all in code as well. And I was the same in the beginning. I was like, oh no, storyboards are fine and everything. But that meant you had to have everything on the storyboard. And then some of it would have been hidden, and some of, and so on. And there was a lot of code behind it to say when this is visible, then this isn't. And it got so hard to maintain, especially, you know, in Food Planner, like you have, if you don't have any meal plan for today, right, and you open the app, instead of showing you a picture of what you're gonna have, it says, oh, you don't have anything here, here's, you know, either go straight to your recipes, or you can be inspired by others recipes other users put in. And I used to have that all in one screen, and the image used to be on top of it, and when there was no planned meal, the image was set to hidden, and then the buttons would show up. But what ended up happening was, if you had any network difficulties or your internet was slow, the buttons would show up first, and then when the recipe finally loaded, the buttons were hidden, but they were still clickable through the image for whatever reason, and it was really annoying, because then the user would have clicked on the picture or tapped on the picture, and instead of being taken to the recipe as he should have been at that time, he was taken to the recipe list to plan a meal, and it was really confusing. So anytime a UI element is hidden or shown or whatever, that's all done in code, and it's being laid out in code right now, because I can control I can control the trigger actions then, because, you know, you can't trigger UI element that doesn't exist at that time, you know.
Yeah, that's,
and
I'm sorry, go ahead,
go on.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was saying I've learned to appreciate doing UI in code, because it's much more sensible. And like you said, if you want to adjust something to be in proportion with someone else or something else, it's just maths. Like, oh, well, this has to be, I want the bottom of this button to be half of the width of the button under the picture. So, you know, in the welcome screen, when you have the picture and it's the make now button, that's sort of centered on the bottom constraint of the picture. to do that in storyboards, oh, you have to, you know, faff around with constraints, and then God forbid you're in a small device because then the button's smaller, and then, you know, that constraint is variable and so on. In code, it's just like three lines of code to say, well, height of the button times two, that's your constraint, or divided by two, that's your constraint. And since I kind of figure out the sort of the geometry of it, it's much easier to write it down than you know, use your mouse or touchpad to move a button one pixel at a time.
Yeah. One of another thing that I've found, like, especially when you have a UI that is variable, essentially, you know, it depends on the context. If you have all the cases in your storyboard, essentially, like how you said, like if you're going to have like your view show something different when you have information or when you don't have information, if you do all of that in one storyboard, then you have to have all of that stuff in the storyboard, and then it just looks messy.
So
the nice thing about doing it in code too is you can do stuff that like just doesn't seem apparent in storyboard. So like you could actually just swap out views. Like you don't even have to, you could just have two different, you could have a just one view that is like the placeholder view that does things, and then when you do something, you can actually just swap out that view for another view or something, you know. So you could do stuff like that. Like that doesn't seem very apparent when you're doing it in storyboards. You could have, you know,
exactly.
So it's just like,
and then,
yeah.
And then if you need to go and change something, you know, 3 weeks later, after you've laid it out, you need to dig through all the layers in the storyboards just to find the thing you need to change. And then, you know, it'll move on top or something. And it just creates a lot of headaches. So I like storyboards for simple layouts, like a table view, like the calendar view I have in your meal calendar, the second tab. The table and the calendar are all set up in storyboards. But then when you tap on the expand button on the calendar, that's all done in code. So it's kind of marrying the setup in storyboards and then whatever happens in code and kind of making best of both worlds. But the entirety of the welcome screen and anytime there's an animated view, that happens in code. So I'm kind of trying to use both because I don't really think that it's time consuming doing everything in code. And if it's simple enough, you can just do it in storyboards. But if you wanted something, you know, something to pop and be very, very sort of showy, then you're probably going to do it that in code.
Yeah. And one of the things that I like, especially whenever you're using, like if you need a reference constraints, I don't really like making IB outlets for constraints. It feels easier to do it. It's not even necessarily easier, but it just feels a little more, I don't know. I try to avoid as many IB outlets as possible. It just doesn't feel as nice, I guess. It's a far cry from where I was, you know, a year ago, where mm-hmm. everything was IB outlets. And like, you know, I would have trouble with visualizing like view math essentially. But now, you know, it's just one of those things. It's like, as long as you keep working at it and like, you know, you start getting into like little things, like when you start working with animations and you start to understand how the view hierarchies work. And like, you know, what are you even really looking at? I learned a whole lot about views and stuff just from learning animations and like transition context and like just weird, just all sorts of different things. It's I don't know. It's pretty cool.
True. And I think that's the sort of the appeal of iOS development, because it is, you know, you can do everything in code. And like, I think like we talked last time in the first episode I was in, when, you know, I couldn't hack it if it was all in Objective-C because it just looked so alien. But, you know, Swift is friendly enough that you kind of, you don't know you're doing code when you're doing code because it all kind of seems natural language. And then with storyboards, it's even easier because then you don't have to sort of if you're when you're learning, you don't have to worry about, oh, how does this work? So it's the sort of the hard part in the beginning is just focusing on learning how to make the code work, and then the views and stuff you can do in storyboards, and you could do a perfectly acceptable app and submit it to the App Store just using storyboards and never touching UI and code. But once you kind of get to it, I don't know, there's sort of an appeal to it, and you kind of feel like, you know, you're in the Matrix, and it's like, oh, letters flying down and you can all read them. it does have a sort of a hackerish feeling to it, but it is enjoyable, and recently, like the last few releases, I've been doing it more and more in code, and I find it more fulfilling, because it'll take a few tries to get, you know, the sizes and everything right, but just with the drawer, and that was, if I were to do that in storyboards, it would have been a nice nightmare, because you'd have to do, you know, constraint hogging and, you know, stuff like that, whereas with this, it's all dependent on the size, on the width of the screen, and then all the other constraints just are figured out based on maths, rather than, you know, running multiple test builds just to get it right on every device.
Yeah, that's one thing that I found, because like the stuff that was existing already in storyboards that I didn't want to really change. Every time, so when I was like, because a lot of the stuff was like, and honestly, like I learned more about storyboards from doing things in code, because like I didn't think about storyboards in the way that I thought about things in code. So it's like when I started doing UI in code, you know, you like when you're writing code, you think, oh yeah, I just want this to be half of like the width of this, you know, of this particular element. And then like in storyboards, I was like, well, like I never did that in storyboards. So I was like, well, if I'm doing it in code, there's got to be a way to do it in storyboards. So then and right now, the only approach that I'm aware of is like, so you make it like the view is equal to, like, you know, you say it's equal to first, like that's how I've, the only way I've been able to do it. Like you control click over to whatever the view element is that you want to be proportional to. Make it equal widths or equal heights or however you want to do it. And then you change the scale of that. You change the multiplier of that constraint. So like if you want it to be half, the multiplier will be 0.5. And so you've got to take a couple steps. And in that meantime, like, you know, first your element blows up to the size of whatever element that you're doing, and then you change it, and then it kind of shrinks back. And I guess it's kind of nice in the way that you get to see what's going on as you're doing it. But I don't know. I just like control clicking. So you got control click. So that's one step. Then choosing equal widths. That's a second step. And then you've got to click into the constraint inspector. And so that's probably one or two clicks to get there, depending on if you have everything pulled out, and then you got to go into there. So it's like you've got all these steps to do the same thing of what you can do in code. And like, you know, you could essentially do it in one line if you do it inside of it, and it's layout constraint.activate.
Yeah. Have you worked with IB inspectables in your app?
A little bit. So Kevin actually had some IB inspectables already set up. I haven't done it too much. I understand what they do and what they're for, like, but I've never really set it up myself. Do you have some IB inspectable stuff?
Yeah, I've one thing, and it's, you know, in Food Planner, when you go to add a recipe, so if you go to, plan a meal, if you go to your meal calendar and then you press the little plus, the segmented control there between saved recipe and a manual recipe. I didn't like the stock UI segmented control, you know, the squarish one, and I wanted something more round and more sort of animated. So I've created this. It's essentially a control that I created, but it does the same thing as a segmented control, but you know, it has round corners and it's animated, so the thing slides from side to side rather than just appearing where you tap. So that was essentially just, that was the first time I've ever created something in code that was reflected in a storyboard, but it's also, you know, it kind of marries the two concepts as well. And it's I like how, because it's an IB inspectable, you can, you can see the changes live in the storyboards before you run your build.
Yeah, I think Kevin had made some extension. He made an extension to UI View, I think, that, and he made that IB, one of them's IB inspectable is the attribute, and then IB designable is what you have to, like, it's the annotation you give, like, whatever the thing is, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah, he made, like, he made it to where, you know, you could play around with the shadows in storyboards, and then you could play around with corner radiuses and stuff like that. He had that set up, and that was pretty nice to do. And on, you know, I, like I said, like when I saw it, I was like, that's when it made a little more sense to me, because like I'd never messed with it before, because like even when I was doing all my layout in storyboards, but then I would do like customizations in code. So like if I had like a view, like a custom view or whatever in my storyboard, I would just kind of set it up and do the constraints in storyboards, and then change everything about it in code. Like, so if I needed a corner radius, that was done in code. It's definitely a cool thing to use, especially if, like, you know, if you like both of them, both doing it in code and in storyboards, and especially if somebody that you're working with, like if you're working with somebody on something, and then, you know, maybe they're not as good with UI and code, you know, they're still able to use those elements in a format that they're more comfortable with.
And it sort of allows for portability as well, because, you know, if it's all fine and well if you're using the built-in UI controls and so on, but if you wanna reuse something, you'd have to build it again or whatever, or like if you're doing it in code, even more so, you'd have to point it to the right thing, right element on storyboards and so on. But if you do a IB inspectable, then you can just port that wherever you want. You can even do a CocoaPod. So one of the people I follow on Twitter did this very nice UI search bar implementation, where the little magnifying glass animates to become the cursor when you click on it. So you know how you have that little magnifying glass in the left side of the search bar? Once you focus on the search bar, it sort of flips to the side and it becomes a cursor, and then you just type from there on, and it looks really sleek and nice. And I think they've released it as a CocoaPod. I think it's Kyle Burkholder.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. I saw that. It looked really cool. I liked it a lot. Yeah, it was very well done. It's like one of those nice little things that, you know, that you can put into your application, and it just kind of looks nice. It's like one of those little things that makes your app just a little delightful. It's like, oh wow, that's pretty cool. It's like not gonna groundbreakingly like make your app a huge success, but it's like just makes it that tiny bit more enjoyable to use.
Exactly. And it's these little things, because, you know, you can make enough the best, you know, be the bee's knees in functionality, but it also kind of has to look nice. It has to be, you know, in a sense, there has to be this sort of design trigger on it, where you just, it looks nice to look at, but it also works perfectly, and it's amazing in functionality. But if it's just hacked together with basic built-in UI kit controls and so on, it's not as nice to use then, you know.
That's definitely like the thing that I struggled with the most. I've gotten a bit better at, you know, custom UI and design and stuff like that, especially, you know, picking up some stuff from seeing how Kevin works. And it's like when I did my inventory application, it was all stock UI kit. I didn't customize a dang thing, and most of that was because I had to get it done so fast.
Yeah, and it's also in industry, and it's not going to be a wide release, so then it's fine. You know, I guess if you're going for a user base, you need to sort of reel your users in and then keep them there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's mostly what I'm essentially working on. But, you know, I've got enough side projects as it is. My side all the side stuff that I've got going on. I don't even have time for my own project, but yeah, you know, it's like, it's still, it's my goal for my inventory app is to be like publicly released before the end of the year, because that's when people do their annual inventories. So that would be the best season to do. So yeah. my goal is December 1st. We'll see, because I've got a lot of other stuff going on that I'll be announcing soon, but I'm not going to get into it this episode, but yeah. So I want to pivot a little bit, because we ended up going on this UI and code tangent, but I wanted to talk about releasing to the store. So we talked about test flight, and what was your release process like, and how did it feel different than, like, so you had all your beta testers, and all of them, the ones that stayed engaged, you know, they're already, like, you could say, expert users at it. So you weren't really dealing with too many, like, on people onboarding. Going to release after beta?
Well, funny you should mention that. So onboarding was a challenge, right? So when I've been using this app in multiple iterations over the past 12 months, right? And to me, the onboarding was never an issue to me, because I didn't have to onboard myself. And then when I first released the beta, the onboarding bit for the users was like just a sort of a step, and then they moved on. And now, because the testers I have now have been using the app for at least, you know, 4 to 6 months, they never have to do the onboarding again. So before I was releasing my app, it occurred to me that the onboarding is kind of horrible. So I had to redesign all the sort of sign up screens, the login screen, and then the first few steps. The first release in the app store didn't have any tutorials. So it's essentially, you just launch the app and it's like, here, knock yourself out, do stuff with it. You know, the users weren't told what to do, where to click, and, you know, how to import stuff and anything like that. It's only in the 1.1 release that came out 2 weeks ago, I've added the drawers that have a tutorial. So it essentially just tells you, on this screen you can do this, you know, swipe left on the cell to show options, and, you know, essentially walking people through. Because I've noticed that after I released to the store, I got maybe like 30, 40 downloads. And that was it. People downloaded it once, run it twice the day they downloaded this, and never used it again. And that was probably because they didn't know how to use it, or even maybe it didn't feel their need or whatever. But I didn't make it easy for them to start using the app. And because I never had, I couldn't test it in test flight, because all my users sort of had the onboarding gone through. In the latest test flight iterations, I've asked the users to uninstall the app and then install it again, so they would go through the onboarding, or like even create a new account or so on. I even in the test flight build, I've added a button to say unregister, so then it would sort of delete your account, but save your recipes and so on, so you wouldn't have to add them again. That was just functionality for testing, but I might add it later for like user portability. And I've had to do all this since release, because I've released it to the App Store. That wasn't there, and now a month later, I've added it in the 0.1 release, and now my user retention has kind of gone up, and they're using it more, and it kind of helps that I've on my website, I've added a few FAQs that explain what to do, and, you know, if the app crashes in a particular point, how to report it to me, or is it caused, like we talked earlier, about your network issues, and then, you know, how to add a recipe, what happens if you can't add a recipe, or more importantly, with GDPR, some recipes are, you know, in sites that will show you the whole full page GDPR terms of service and so on, and then you have to scroll all the way down and then click on the button, then untick stuff. So because of this, some recipes that are added can't be shown in the app. Well, they can be shown in the app. It's just that Safari WebView is a bit limited in app, especially when it comes to ticking fields, ticking radio buttons and fields. So in those cases, I've asked users that if they really want to use this recipe, open it in Safari first and do it there. And then the cookie stays on device and my app can use it then to use the recipe. You know, a lot of things that would never occur to me since launch or before launch, I had to add since launch. And it was mostly about onboarding. So thanks for asking that question, because it's not something I... Honestly, and I don't know if you're the same with the app you're doing, acquiring new users sort of isn't the thing you think of when you release the app, because you've been a user for so long that you know it inside out, and your testers know it inside out, and it mightn't come up before release.
Yeah, you know, the nice thing about the app that I'm actively working on is that there's not really a... There's no sign in process. It's just the game. So at some point, probably the next iteration, because we already kind of had it a little bit, but then we took it out and just to reduce a little complexity for 1.0. But we had Game Center in there so that people could track like their you know, like see how they stack up against like other people playing the game. The reason why it was pulled from 1.0 was because it was kind of like, we kind of need to set up separate tiers, because like there's an easy mode, we've got three levels of difficulty, easy, medium, and hard. So if somebody finishes easy in 10 seconds, they shouldn't be in first place if, you know, somebody beat hard in 30 seconds, because hard has like, you know, a greater number of, you know, so figuring out how to like segment the leaderboards based on like maybe easy, medium, hard, or like, you know, or figuring out a way to weight the difficulties to see like maybe based on number of cards on the screen. You know, I don't know exactly how, so it was those kinds of things to think about, whereas it became apparent that like this isn't really that necessary for 1.0. It's not like you're not actively playing with people. It's more or less just fun to see where you're at against other people. But you know, nobody's you know, it's not like, at least in my opinion, I've used games that use Game Center, but I never have looked at Game Center to see, like, I've never looked at the leaderboards. It's just not something that, so like, as we kind of like threw it back and forth, it's like, this will be good. You know, this is something to add, but it's not like it's not a deal breaker for it to not be in the first version.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Cause like, I don't use Game Center unless it's like a multiplayer game. So, you know, it's one of the things that's nice to have, but doesn't really add much, unless it's like I said, a multiplayer game where the leaderboards and so on. You need that for managing your interactions.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you had? We're kind of coming up on time, but you know, I want you to be able to you know, talk about anything else that you think would be interesting to talk about.
Well, one of the things, and kind of to bring back to TestFlight, is active users are hard to come by, and ones that would engage. So you know, I'd kind of like to use this platform to maybe ask if any of the listeners would be interested in joining. So I don't know if that's okay.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So yeah, just, you know, hit me up on Twitter and at boywithax, or you know, email me on greg@apparmory.com. That's my website, and we can get something going. Because I like I said, I like to sort of start two groups of testers that test the same feature but implement it differently to see which one's better. Because over the past few iterations of TestFlight, I actually had to. It was the build. The only difference between the builds was that I tweaked one thing in the future, and then see, and I waited for feedback, and that kind of that takes time because some people mightn't have checked the first version of the iteration, and you know, and comparing and contrasting was very hard. So I'd like to sort of get the sort of competitive features, I guess, going.
Right, A/B testing essentially. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. If anybody wants to be a beta tester, has never really been a beta tester, and they want to figure out how to share their recipes efficiently, definitely check out Greg's app. So yeah, as far as, oh, I remember I didn't want to interrupt you. That's one thing I used to do that a lot. And I caught because I, you know, you go back and listen, especially podcasting, you listen to your first episodes, and I noticed that and I wouldn't do it on purpose, right? It, because like sometimes like something is said and you're like, it's like, oh, is it like that? But you also want them to be able to finish their thoughts. One thing that you said is that you talk when you're talking about UI Property View Animator, and you asked guys on another podcast, that was MTJC, right?
Yes.
Because I remember them talking about you. And one thing that I will say is that I feel like I'm going to be bold here. I'm the only person in podcasting that knows how to pronounce your last
yes.
name, because they butchered it. I don't remember if it was Tim Mitra or if it was, Jaime.
Yeah, I think both.
But some, you know, they tried to say your name, and they're like Sizidlo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, ha! I know how to pronounce his name. It's Shidwa. Figure it out. Yeah.
Well, in fairness, it's a hard name to pronounce. I should probably put a international pronunciation guide just behind it on Twitter, so people know.
I remember whenever I first brought you on, I was like, okay, let's, like, first things first, how do I pronounce your last name? You definitely wouldn't think, you wouldn't, like, looking at your name, you wouldn't think, oh yeah, that looks like it'd be pronounced Shidwa.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, you know, depends where you're from, like, you know, people from Poland.
Well, as an American, right? Or, you know, or I would imagine that a lot of English people and Irish people and anywhere that you go, that's not like, that's Polish last name. That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah. I would imagine anyone not familiar with how to pronounce Polish names probably pronounces it incorrectly the first time they see it.
Oh yeah. At this point, I don't even hear it. I've gotten used to it, if I'm honest.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Well, Greg, I really appreciate you coming back on the show. You know, it was a real, real treat bringing you back on, talking about your app. And it's called, the name's gone through a few iterations. It's called Meals currently. Is that correct?
Well, so it's Meals Food Planner.
Or is it called Food Planner?
Because the food planner part is important.
Okay.
If you search Meals in the App Store, it'll come up. The names had to change because I've noticed that since I came up with it, before release, somebody else had trademarked and released the same name that I was going to use. So that's why, you know.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was a bit of a bother because when I submitted it to the App Store, it's like, oh, you can't use that name. So fair enough.
Oh.
So that's why now it's long. I still call it Food Planner because that's what it's always been in my head. But, you know, in the App Store, it's meals- Food Planner. And you can
gotcha.
You can search Meals and it'll just come up.
Yeah, I remember when I saw on the phone, the it says Meals. You don't see the dash in the thing, but yeah, that's why. Yeah, so yeah, anybody that wants to, or just go check out Greg's app. It's on the App Store, Meals-Food Planner. Like I said, thank you for coming on. Do you want to throw out your information out there again, just in case people missed it, for how to reach you?
So if you want to, you know, become a tester or just ask me anything, you can hit me up on Twitter at boywithax or email me greg@apparmory.com.
And you all can find me on Twitter at Steven_0351. My DMs are open. Feel free to reach out to me for pretty much anything. I'm an open book. But once again, Greg, thanks for coming on the show. It's a treat having you again.